This is a message for members of Thrive and Financial for Lutherans. Thrive and Financial will match 50 cents on each dollar you donate to Lutheran Public Radio, up to $300. So if you donate $300 to Lutheran Public Radio, Thrivent will send us an additional check for $150. For more information, look for the Thrivent Giving Plus gift form under the Donate page of our website, issuesetc.org. Make your gift to us go further with Thrivent Giving Plus.
Well, I'm given to believe that this category of publishing is a real moneymaker. And I'm not just talking about the Harry Potter books or the Twilight books or any of the other books that have been so unbelievably popular with young people. You go, just do it. Go to a bookstore, any old bookstore, and look at how much of the shelf space there is now dedicated to fiction that is primarily aimed at kids. Not necessarily little children. I'm not talking about the back section with the kids, although for the little children, I'm talking about teenagers. They read. Now, what are they reading? And what is the message? What are the messages that they find when they pick up the average, kind of book about themselves, the fictionalized versions of teenage life in America? David Mills joins us to talk about the books your children read and their messages. He's a married father of four children outside Pittsburgh. He's author of an article in a recent issue of Touchstone Magazine titled Bad Books for Kids. David, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me.
David, you've been doing a lot of reading of this kind of fiction and literature out there. And as you've been doing this, what about the books our kids are reading shocked you the most?
Well, when I went to the store to do the sort of final research for the article, I suppose I wasn't so much shocked because I've been reading these since our eldest started reading, as depressed. And just the low, and not even actually talking about the moral quality, just the lack of heroism in any of the stories, the lack of idealism, the lack of sort of the stories like Treasure Island, which really do sort of portray virtue and give you a sense of adventure and heroism and so on. So and I wasn't, at this point I'm not shocked, but I do find it kind of depressing that that even the better stories aim so low. And the bad ones, of course, aim even lower.
You said that one of the things you found in these kids' books is the general consensus among the authors in the way they tell their stories that kids' lives are terrible. Even if everything's going pretty good, kids' lives are still terrible. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, my guess is the source of that, of course, is these books are being sold to kids who like most of us can remember our adolescence. There's a good bit of self pity involved, and it was a danger for teenagers to feel sorry for themselves and oh woe is me, no matter how affluent you is and you are, and how happy your family is, how much money you have, and so on. Kids just like to feel sorry for themselves. So there's that aspect that I think drives much of the publication is just they're playing to their market. And also, I'm afraid they're playing sometimes to public school teachers and others who assign these problem books, as they're called. Because the families are a problem, but in most of these books, teachers are the salvation. There's often a good teacher, a wise teacher, a teacher who counsels the poor, understands the child and is much more helpful than his or her parents ever are. So I think, getting a little off your question, but they're driven by certain market forces. When you get to talk about the families in these stories, the family is usually dysfunctional at some point. The parents are generally clueless. They don't really understand the kid or where it's usually she, where she's coming from, what she's dealing with. They have idealistic views of school when she's having a terrible time. They're fighting or bickering or they don't pay attention to her. Sibling, if there's older siblings, usually unconcerned. If it's a younger sibling, he's annoying. So the portrayal is usually of a family they're obviously families like that, and every family has fallen in some significant way, but there's rarely a happy family or even a normal family, even a normally happy family. They're all this kind of dysfunctional, self-centered, clashing, disruptive, disorganized, chaotic sort of families.
So what is it? The kids depicted in this fiction kind of, is it every man for himself?
Oh, that's a very good question. I hadn't looked at it that way. Well, in some of the stories, you know, the children really are alone, but usually they have their real family is their peer group, a small knot of friends or a best friend or two or three friends that really function as the people who support them and encourage them and pick them up when they fall. As I said, there's often a sympathetic or wise old teacher who when their parents are such failures, the teacher comes in and encourages them and guides them and gives them a better vision for life and so on. So it's not completely Darwinian, but there is often the idea that there's just a small knot of people they can trust, because most of the other kids at high school are in some way awful or abominable, and most of the people in their neighborhoods and so on. So it's not completely Darwinian, it's not completely individualistic, but it's usually a small group that that really functions as their family as a sort of haven in a heartless world.
You mentioned before that the teachers often in these problem books come off pretty well. What about other figures of authority?
Well, in general, and obviously I'm generalizing about literally thousands of books and some dozens or hundreds I've read, but generally, except for these rare exceptions, and mainly teachers, the authority figures in their lives are generally clueless or useless. Parents certainly, even the loving parents, tend to be clueless, and you rarely. In fact, I haven't looked at a book recently that had a pastor of any a religious figure of any sort, unless he was some sort of New Age guru or leader. The pastors don't appear. Parents are clueless. Besides the wise teachers, they're sometimes awful teachers. There's a certain degree of cynicism about politicians to the rare extent they think about wider issues at all. Any sort of governmental or wider public figure is usually corrupt or self-centered or something. So, no, it's really quite a negative view of authority as authority. I mean, and that you don't have authority figures to look up to. They're generally hopeless in some way.
You mentioned that the religious figures of authority very rarely appear. What about God?
Now God occasionally makes an appearance, but let me think how to put this best. The God who makes an appearance is always simply God. Almost always simply God. In a sense, it's a general force, not necessarily transcendent. It's sort of up there, a foundation of reality, or a sort of generally benevolent spirit, or something like that. I mean, there's rarely. Very rarely an encounter with Jesus, or as a Christian would understand it, even with the particular other Buddhist or Hindu or Islamic traditions. The religion never gets that specific. So when they think about God, the whole question is whether there's this benevolent force out there making sure the universe means something, or if there's not, or it's all for grabs, it's all chaos. But they're often spiritual or religious, but it's only in that very, very, very general sense. And this God is rarely, if ever, any sort of moral lawgiver. That's almost definitely out.
Is there one of these books or two that you read that you think are kind of archetypical for, what is being presented to our kids fictionally in publishing today?
Oh, that's a very good question. Another very good question. I read a whole batch of them, and I'm not sure if there's any. I mean, I sort of hesitate to even give the titles out. What I would suggest to a parent, if you're just interested in following this up, is as I did. I went to the local chain bookstore, and you walk down the middle aisle, and the children's section is the back, and they usually have several tables you have to walk by to get to the children's section, with both young adult and slightly. One table is for young adults, and when I went, and another table is for slightly younger children, and just sort of leaf through the books that are just sitting on the table there. It would be best guy, but they all basically fit a broad pattern. So I'm not sure I think of one that's really archetypal.
Do we have any idea what kind of we talk about life imitating art or vice versa? I mean, obviously this is the authors of these books are adults. Do you get a sense, as having perused these things, that they are casting an accurate picture of teenage life, or are they imposing upon them some adult sensibilities about what teenage life must be like for these kids?
That's another good question. I wish I thought of that when I was writing the essay. Well, put like that, actually, I think they work in two. Like many things, many writings, fiction especially, you know, they work in two directions. You know, when they attract readers, and you know, I certainly remember this from my high school, many of the things from high school days, like, you know, absolutely ridiculous, annoying gym teachers and, you know, and bullies who got away with bullying and teachers' pets who got away with all sorts of things because the teachers wouldn't discipline them. So, you know, I think they often describe things that the kids, yeah, that's what I've experienced. And, you know, it's helpful often to see things that you've experienced put into a story. And so they do work that way, and they do sort of, they build their readership that way. Kids tap into this thing and say, yeah, that's my life. I know, that's exactly like Mr. So-and-so. But on the other hand, they also project, I think, this sort of uniformly secular, bleak, anti-parent, anti-family, anti-traditional point of view that you know, children tend to be much more idealistic until they're corrupted. I mean, they love things like Treasure Island and you know, the boy Jim doing these wonderful, heroic, brave things. But they do project this darker vision of things. Like you know, they said, the families are almost you know almost always dysfunctional, and so they did tend to suggest that's the way the world is really like. So yeah, I think you know, one sense they do describe something that kids can recognize, and another sense more generally they describe a world that's much bleaker and darker and in various other ways off or wrong than it really is.
It's Wednesday afternoon, October the 14th. I want to hear from you on the subject of bad books for kids. Give us a call, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. You can email questions or comments to us, talkback@issuesetc.org. We get those questions or comments via email here in the studio in real time. Or you can Twitter us at IssuesETC. I'm Todd Wilkin. David Mills is our guest, married father of four children outside Pittsburgh and author of an article in a recent issue of Touchstone Magazine titled Bad Books for Kids. Stay tuned.
Thanks to God's gift of the Internet, people are listening to Issues Etc. around the world.
Hi, this is Ville calling from Finland. I believe the day will come when you cannot enter the office as a pastor in the ELCA unless you subscribe to the ordination of gays and lesbians. And why do I believe that? Because Americans are sinners like we Finns are.
Listen to what you want, when you want, wherever you are. IssuesETC.org.
When you hear the words new music for your congregation, do you automatically think of mindless praise music? Well, think again. Liturgy Solutions has new compositions for all seasons of the church year that are firmly grounded in the Reformation truths of Christ for us in Word and Sacrament. Check us out on the web at www.liturgysolutions.com. At Liturgy Solutions, we don't do worship, we're deep into liturgy. www.liturgysolutions.com.
Theology for Blue Collar, White Collar, and Clerical Collar. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Would you like to post your favorite Issues Etc. audio segments on your website or blog? Well, we've made it easy for you. Just go to the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, click the embed green logo, and copy and paste the embed code on your website or blog. It's just like posting a YouTube video. Embed Issues Etc. audio on your website or blog today. We love our on-demand listeners. Old theology, new technology. IssuesETC.org.
Here's a new way to stay connected to Issues Etc. Check out our page on Facebook. Network with fellow Issues Etc. junkies. Sign up to become a fan, and we'll send you updates on future topics and guests. You'll even find photos of in-studio guests, Todd drinking chelada, and highlights from our one-year anniversary open house. You'll discover that Todd, Jeff, and Craig really do have faces for radio on Facebook. Issues Etc. on Facebook. Another way to stay connected to Issues Etc. Facebook.com/IssuesETC.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about the books your children read and their messages. David Mills is our guest. It's been recently observed by a Christian researcher that the religion of America's young people is therapeutic moralistic deism. It sounds like that's pretty accurately reflected, at least kind of that worldview in the books our kids are reading. I do find it ironic that these books are largely written by adults, and And maybe it says more about how adults, the adults who write these books, view the world than perhaps how the kids who read them do. Of course, you cannot discount the influence. Before we're done with our conversation, we'll get some advice from David Mills on what parents can do with regard to the books that their kids are reading. 1-877-623-MY-IE. Parents, what do you think? Email us, talkback at issuesetc.org, or Twitter us at issuesetc. I'm wondering about the general moral view. You write at one point in your article when you're assessing these kids' books that moral judgments seem to be the only thing that is really definitively wrong all the time. Talk about that.
Well, it's a funny sort of thing, as you guess. I mean, I'm sure you've dealt with this on the program a lot. But it is relativism, you know, of various sorts, is the default philosophy. It's, if it's okay for you and it doesn't harm anyone else and everyone's consenting, that's cool. And, of course, this comes out in the children's stories, especially the youth stories, especially in terms of teenage sexual behavior. So there's absolutely no moral rules allowed us to do this, don't do that. It's only for the, you know, as I say at one point, the view of sexuality is your body is something you can use as you would use a bank account. You spend it or save it as you will for your own private reasons, but no one can tell you right from wrong whether to sleep with someone or not. So you have that kind of default relativism. But on the other hand, I mean, there were certain sort of cultural pieties that really are treated as absolutes. I mean, racism is bad, sexism is bad, and sexism in that sense is really to seem to mean include any belief that there's actually a difference between boys and girls, and male and female. Of course, the irony there is that these stories usually, especially the problem stories, hinge on, you know, differences between boys and girls and the way they act. But certain environmental viewpoints and other things are treated as absolute. So you do have this funny sort of relativism in certain areas, the convenient areas like sexuality, and this absolutism on all the sort of mainstream cultural or liberal pieties.
What is the fundamental difference, in your opinion, between what we've been talking about so far and those works you've alluded to? Those, I guess we could call them in the vein of the classics of Western literature that used to be standard fare, at least in schools, for kids' initial exposure to reading. What's the basic difference there, in your opinion?
I think there are probably two basic differences, two pillars or whatever. The one is that the great books, and written by, you know, a diversity of people from diversity of cultures and times and ages, from, you know, Homer onwards, you know, there is a moral order. There is right and wrong. Now, we look back and read Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey, and realize that the Greek morality was not all it should have been. But there were codes. There was right things to do and wrong things to do. There was none of this sort of default relativism we see today. So that's the first difference. Is even if the morality is defective, there is a moral order. There is a right and wrong, and that you don't make it up, and it's your job to conform yourself to it, and not do what you feel like. And the second one, I think, and this actually strikes me in some ways more, is really the lack of or the difference in heroism between the two. You know, the older books, I keep mentioning Treasure Island because it was a book I loved and loved reading to our children. You know, Treasure Island, there's the boy is called to heroism, to sacrifice, to adventure. And, that's part of what makes it a wonderful story. So the boy who risks himself, in fact, risks his own life, even though he's a little boy, to do the right thing, to save his friends, to save the ship, and so on. So I think that's actually the other big difference that strikes me, and I think really the contemporary books really do harm kids by lacking the sense of adventure and heroism and self-sacrifice and all these things that make you cheer for young Jim in Treasure Island or, you know, any number of other stories. So those two, I think, the contemporary books lack that sense of a moral order, and they also, and perhaps even more damaging, lack that sense of heroism and adventure.
Is it going too far to say that what we find in so much of the popular kids' literature today is kind of a soft form of nihilism?
Yes, I don't think it's going too far. As I say in the article, I think the sort of the general philosophy behind the stories is what I think I call thinking back to when I wrote it several months ago, adolescent existentialism is, you know, there is no meaning to the world, but you got to live in it, so you make your own meaning, and it's up to you to make your own establish your own sense of right and wrong and good and evil and make up what meaning you can. So it is, I mean, fundamentally that's nihilistic, because they're saying there's nothing beneath or beyond your choice, but it's presented in that kind of pop existentialist way. You know, when I was young, we were reading Camus and things like that. Now that kind of philosophy has been dialed several levels down to this, as I say, adolescent existentialism. So yeah, it is a form of nihilism, but it's presented as this sort of self-creation and this imperative to make your own world, and so it's dressed up in a little more, sorry to say heroic, and that's not the word I want, but it's dressed up a little more than basic nihilism.
Josh in Tucson, Arizona, emails this to us. Just tuned in, so I'm not sure if you've covered this or are talking about the same group, but Philip Pullman, and you do mention him in your article, Philip Pullman's Dark Materials trilogy is terrifying. Pullman's stated purpose is the destruction of Christianity. He takes the Milton's Paradise Lost and turns it on its head, making Satan the hero and God the villain. But he does this in a charming, beautiful way so that you could read up to halfway through the final book before realizing that you're cheering for evil rather than good. Keep up the good work. Your thoughts there on Pullman's trilogy, The Dark Materials?
Oh, actually, I read the book and gave a paper on them some years ago, which I haven't published yet. I disagree somewhat with your correspondent. He is up to no good in his general general drive, as the writer said. But the thing I wrote about said in my paper that I think is true is he's trying to write he considers himself the anti C.S. Lewis. He's trying to write a novel that, as he said, makes the fall a good thing, a fall into knowledge and maturity and all that kind of thing. You know, basic existentialism, as we were saying. But what you find when you read the book is he can't do what he wants to do without the Christian story. So there are all sorts of hints throughout the book, and all sorts of stories that are based on the reality of a fundamental moral order, and in fact, and a Christian, including and also a Christian idea of immortality and eternal reward, and so on. So, for example, there's one very moving scene in the last book where this girl, who's the main character, who just lies through her teeth all the time, is in his version of hell, and she's surrounded by these shades or ghosts of people who have died, and they're being harassed by these harpies, these sort of vulture-like women creatures, and attacked, and she starts telling a story about life on Earth, or life, and everything grows silent. She suddenly looks at all these harpies who'd been attacking her, and these people were sitting there quietly, and she says, why aren't you bothering us? Why aren't you attacking us anymore? And they said, because you told the truth. And I'm not quoting it exactly, but it's a very moving scene about the reality of truth. C.S. Lewis could have written it. So what you find, even in Pullman, who's trying to write an atheist fantasy, is he can't write an atheist fantasy that works without bringing in some elements of Christianity, some Christian truths.
Finally, then, with only about 30 seconds, what's the best piece of advice you would give parents about the books their kids are reading? About 30 seconds.
Well, the best piece of advice is vet the books your children want to read on your own, even though it's a pain in the neck. And second, spend a good bit of time each evening or each day, if you can, reading the classics to them and talking about them, reading them out loud to your children. Tolkien, Lewis, Robert Louis Stevenson, Homer, all these things. So vet the books they're reading on their own, and just read a lot to them, as much as you can, of the great stuff.
David Mills is a married father of four outside of Pittsburgh and author of an article in a recent issue of Touchstone Magazine titled Bad Books for Kids. You'll find a link to Touchstone Magazine at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on demand. David, thanks for being our guest.
Well, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, speaking of books, in the second hour of the program, just on the other side of this break, I want your answer to this question. There's a Baptist church down south that has decided to have an old-fashioned book burning. There are books out there they don't like. They think they're harmful to the faith of Christians. They teach terrible errors, and there certainly are a lot of books like that out there. Their solution, an old-fashioned book burning. They want to have one every Halloween as long as they can do it. They're even burning some Christian books by Christian authors, Rick Warren, James Dobson, Billy Graham. Now, golly, there's some stuff in their books that I wouldn't recommend to any Christian, but should you burn the books? They're even burning some Bibles. In fact, anything that isn't the King James Version, they're planning to burn too. Now, if your pastor suggested this publicity stunt, whatever you want to call it, how would you react? What do you think this activity, this book burning, what message does it send to the world, to the rest of Christianity? I want to hear from you. It's Audio Open Lines on the other side of the break. You'll hear the story, and then I want your answers to those questions. What do you think about an old-fashioned book burning? By the way, there's a book burning in the New Testament, right under the auspices of the apostles. We'll talk about that and hear the story about this church burning books right after this. Hour two is straight ahead.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.